Leanne Moriarty, it's great to have you here at Booktopia.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I can't imagine what the weight of expectation would be on you delivering a book after you've written international bestsellers like Big Little Lies and The Husband's Secret. Did you feel that pressure, or did you have a way of just pushing that to one side and thinking, I'll write it when I'm ready, I'll finish it when I'm ready, and you didn't allow yourself to be made anxious by expectations?
No, I have to admit this was the first time that I felt the weight of expectations. So I feel like when people talk about second book syndrome, that I finally felt it on my seventh novel. But the good thing, the fact that it actually wasn't my second book, was that I could tell myself, well, you've done this a lot of times before. But I was very nervous setting out, because Big Little Lies, I was well into that before The Husband's Secret took off. So this really was the first time that I felt some anxiety.
It's interesting that you say, you know, come on, I've done this before, so I must know how to do this. Because a lot of writers say to me that with every book, they feel like they know nothing and they have to learn all over again with each book. Do you not feel that? Do you feel you do have some foundations that you can kind of build on?
No, you're right. I do feel that. I just felt greater levels of fear. But no, you're right. And that's why I always read, anytime I see an article on, especially a writer I admire, about their writing process, I'm very interested to read it and think, yes, how do you write a book?
Exactly.
So, for example, Anne Tyler, who's one of my favourite authors, she has this thing about using index cards. And so I'm always buying index cards and trying to... And she apparently puts them all out on the hallway floor and writes little scenes and then moves them around. But so I have tried, and I put them on the floor, and I don't understand what she's doing.
And do you have any of those superstitions or rituals, like Isabel Allende, you know, who starts every book on the same day of the year, lights a candle, puts a flower in the vase, like there's a whole thing preamble,
yes,
before she starts to write that has to be right?
No. The only thing I do is when I'm starting a new book, I do like to buy myself a beautiful new notebook. And it has to be a very special, you know, one of the really lovely, expensive ones.
You're not telling me that you're writing these books longhand.
No. But I write my notes.
Okay.
I write my notes. And actually, to be honest, I don't do much with that notebook. I really don't. I don't achieve much until I actually sit at the computer. My sister, Jacqueline Moriarty, she does a lot of notes and does a lot with coloured highlighters. And because I love her writing as well, I've gone out and bought the coloured highlighters too.
I love the idea that you can accessorise this with index cards,
yes,
and highlighters, and that if you've got the right equipment,
exactly.
I think a lot of people think that. If I have the right equipment, then I will be able to tell
to do
the
it.
Story.
Yes, that's right. But for me, that's the other thing my sister does. She goes to a lot of cafes and she likes to look out at the water and things like that. But for me, I have to be just at my desk at the computer screen and just start, and I actually have to start writing, and the only little ritual is turning off the internet. That's absolutely crucial.
Are you a procrastinator though? Do you say to yourself, I'll start when I've done the laundry and all the washing up's done, and I've just got to go and tidy the Tupperware cupboard first because I need a tidy mind in order to be able to concentrate?
I can definitely procrastinate, but not in any of the ways you've mentioned. I'm more likely to say I might just finish the chapter of this book. I'm never worried by domestic things.
So you just might read for a bit longer.
I might read for a bit longer and say I deserve just a little bit more of this book, and maybe this is inspiring me in some way.
Now, in terms of kind of realms of fantasy and imagination, which you deal in obviously all the time, there is obviously a whole other kind of parallel universe when along comes Nicole Kidman and she says, you know, I want the rights to your book. So that's a real pinch me moment. Can you just take me there to that moment, and then your encounter with her, what your expectations were of her, and what did she meet your expectations, or was she completely different?
Well, she was absolutely lovely. I'm trying to think what my expectations were.
Did you think she would be aloof and cool and kind of somewhat remote. Did you find that you bonded very quickly, that you could find common ground very quickly with her?
I think we could, because we're of similar age and similar background, apart from, you know, her glamorous Hollywood life. She was just lovely. I think probably because I'd seen her in interviews, and she'd always come across as a warm person. She was as I expected her to be, and she just made me feel comfortable. But yes, I don't meet celebrities in my day-to-day life, so it was disconcerting, I think, and that's what I've found from meeting people like Reese Witherspoon too, people whose faces you feel like you know so well from seeing them on the screen, suddenly seeing them in real life was a strange feeling.
Now, there's a lot of hoopla that goes with the business of being wooed when Hollywood does want your book badly enough, and clearly Hollywood did want your book badly enough, or your books, I should say. E.L. James told me, who wrote 50 Shades of Grey, that when she went to Hollywood and the bidding war was going on for 50 Shades, she was showered with gifts, and the gifts were, you know, ludicrous. I mean, obscene. We're talking about seriously valuable watches, luxuries of all sorts, incredible enticements. What did you get?
I'm going to send off some emails and say, where are my gifts? No, I didn't get any gifts. I don't think I'm not of Shades of Grey level, so no, I was not showered with gifts. No, duh. It was enough to be showered with a cup of coffee and a lot of lovely emails, and that was enough for me.
No. But are you glad in a way, Leanne, that your children were too young while this process was going on for them to get caught up in the hoopla of celebrity? I mean, obviously, you're a pretty down-to-earth person, and I get the impression that nothing impresses you too much. But children, when they're at a certain age, when they're teenagers, they get very, very hooked into this stuff. Were you glad that that wasn't going to be sort of on their radar yet, what was happening to you?
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about that much. Yes, I guess that's a good thing. They've just enjoyed, they enjoyed visiting the set because there was an ice cream van on the set on the day that we were there. And they like the thought of it, and I think they'll be more interested as they get older. But really, there's not much hoopla surrounding me. I'm not. I'm very much involved from the sidelines, so I don't think there ever will be.
Well, we'll see about that. Let's talk about your new book, Truly Madly Guilty. Let's talk about the themes of the new book then. One of the ones that I find most fascinating is that you've got a character who's got an older mother who is a hoarder.
Yes.
What gave you the idea of addressing this? Because I don't think I've ever seen this particular topic addressed before.
Yes, I read a memoir. I think it was called Dirty Secret. Or it was one of the two. In my acknowledgements, I have two books that I read, and I actually can't remember which I read first, but I had seen somebody recommending it, and it was a memoir of a woman who'd grown up and her mother was a hoarder, and it was just fascinating to me how she went out and about and lived a perfectly normal life, and you know, was dressed perfectly fine and all that sort of thing, but then went back home, and behind closed doors there was, you know, she had this terrible secret, and I just found it so interesting, because I'm always interested in that as a topic, that secret shame that you have where on the outside you appear normal, and you know, the things that, and so then I then started reading so much more about children of hoarders and how they suffer from this syndrome called doorbell dread, because they're terrified at any moment that somebody will knock on the door and that they'll come in and discover their secret.
So they end up having to sort of protect their parent,
yes,
in a way,
yes,
from that,
that's
shame,
right,
don't they?
So
it's not that uncommon.
It's not,
apparently.
More and more people have, as I've talked to people, have said, oh yes, I know somebody who, you can, when you go to their place, you can't sit at the table, you have to go and sit on the bed and have your dinner.
And I think we used to fail to recognise it, because in a certain generation of parents who grew up in the Depression, we thought if you'd grown up in the Depression, it was normal to save newspapers and save string. But now we find that even parents who grew up later than the Depression,
yes,
may succumb to this syndrome, and that it's not necessarily something about the socioeconomic circumstances out there. It's a psychological complaint, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yep, and it can happen to anybody. Mm. Often it can be because of some particular trauma. So you might have a tendency towards attachment to objects, and then you have something happen in your life, and then it gets out of control, and it's horrible. It's horrible for the sufferers, but it's especially for their children growing up in that sort of environment.
But it's a gift for a novelist.
It's a gift for a novelist. That's
now,
right.
Another theme that you tackle is kind of close to home, I gather, which is IVF and the idea of asking friends, I suppose, in this book, to become surrogate parents,
yes,
or to help with the creation of a family. You had difficulty having your children, didn't you? And you tried for quite a long time and had them quite late.
Yes. So I did. I did go through that. I didn't just use my own experiences for this character. What happens to her is completely different. But yes, I do keep coming back to the issue of childlessness. Accidentally, I keep thinking, with my next book, I'll make sure I don't have a character.
What interests you about that? What interests you about childlessness?
It's just I think because all around you, people have children, and so it's such a part of day-to-day life. Every time when you're going through it, every time you turn on the TV, you know, around Mother's Day and things like that. So it was just a...
It's interesting because I don't have children, and the assumptions that people make about you not having children are very stereotypical, that, you know, you've chosen your career over children.
Yeah.
You know, people often sort of prod you and they want you to justify why you might have chosen not to. You always have to explain it, whereas you never have to explain the choice to have children, do you?
Yeah, and that's, I do really want to write about a character who doesn't want to have children one day. I'll have to interview you, because I find that really interesting, and that, of course, is just as valid, you know, if you're in a relationship with somebody who does want to have children and somebody who doesn't, then it's just as valid to say, I don't. So I'm intrigued by that too. But I think just because of my own personal experiences, because it was such a painful time, because I did, that I keep writing about it. But hopefully I've finished writing about it now.
You've got it out of your system.
Yes.
But of course, the thing that adds the sort of tension to the stakes of wanting to have a child is the idea of asking friends whether they will help in this process. IVF is a sort of remote, anonymous process.
Yeah.
But when you ask friends whether they will help you to have a baby, that's a whole different ballgame. And what you do so well is kind of paint a picture of friendship where there are lots of undercurrents and sort of things going on where the friendship isn't quite as robust as perhaps you'd like to think.
Yeah, well, I just found that really interesting to explore. If somebody asks something like that of you, and if your first reaction was actually, no, I really do not want to do this. You know, I've got a thing with my sister that I always say, I'd give you a kidney, but then I think, I really don't want to give you a kidney. But of course, please don't ever ask me. And yes, so this is a very complicated friendship, and I think a lot of friendships are complicated, where you feel a deep affection for this person, but at the same time, so this is, the characters are Clementine and Erica.
Yeah.
At the same time, Clementine is driven mad by Erica because Erica was sort of forced upon her as a child. So to then be asked to do something like that, and yeah, I just wanted to answer that what if question. What if your first reaction was actually no?
So in the dynamic between Erica and Clementine, which is so kind of juicy with all the sort of tension and the sort of undercurrents, would you describe them as frenemies or not?
No, I wouldn't, because that to me, I think that's sort of... I think of that when you're thinking of Mean Girls in high school, where you really don't like the other person, and so it's a nasty, toxic sort of friendship. To me, the reason that they became friends was because Erica had this difficult childhood, and so I was really interested in that, because that, you know, I think happens a lot more than we realise, that people, families take in children without actually adopting or in any way of making it official, but they sort of become couch surfers, so they become an unofficial part of the family.
Well, it also goes to the idea that, you know, you might have been friends in childhood, but not all friendships from childhood are going to survive into adulthood, because the moment you mix in the other variables, like your working life, money, and your partners, who may or may not get on, then friendships aren't necessarily all going to go the distance, are they?
No, that's right. But you have this shared history. And so to me, they're more like sisters. More like sisters.
Well, I know your sisters are very important to you, and family is very important to you. Do you have time for maintaining close friendships? I mean, do you still have a best friend, the way, you know, we all have when we're teenagers and in our 20s?
Yes, I still maintain my friendships. Yeah, I still have a close circle of friends, and I've got friends who I've been friends with since I was 5 years old. But yes, it is difficult. Men don't seem to find it as difficult. They seem to be able to go for years without speaking to a friend and pick up, whereas women seem to need to. There's more pressure to.
I think we feel that we need to do more maintenance. Mm. I would argue that a lot of men don't have very many friends. They have people that they sit on the couch with and maybe watch the footy with and grunt occasionally with, but they don't necessarily, well, they don't seem to require the same amount of intimacy, and the intimacy requires trust, and that requires maintenance.
Yes. But in a way, I admire it, because they can easily pick up the phone after 2 years, and there's not a problem. So I think in a way we can learn a little bit from their friendships. But yes, I still prefer my friendships, where you do want to that level of intimacy. But yeah, in your busy lives, it's hard. So it is sometimes when you're meeting somebody new, you think, I don't have space for another friend.
Exactly. That's what I was getting at, because your life is pretty full on now.
Yeah.
And also, it has changed. I mean, there is no doubt that, you know, the kind of success that you've enjoyed does bring changes. And every writer that I've known go through what you're going through at the moment has found that there are all sorts of little subtle adjustments. And a couple of writer friends have said to me recently that they have noticed the appearance of the green-eyed monster, and that envy has manifested itself in some slight way, or some little oblique remark about, you know, your swish new house. So have you noticed that? Have you come across envy yet?
Oh, my friends must be doing a very good job of hiding it. No, actually, I think I'm very good at picking my friends. I've got lovely friends, so no, I haven't seen it.
And have you noticed something else, Leanne, which is that quite a few articles have said, oh, you know, this is commercial fiction that she writes, and she's selling like hotcakes, but never gets invited to literary festivals, and is kind of sort of, you know, looked down on by the so-called literati. Now, you have been at the Sydney Writers' Festival recently, I think, this year. So have you found that world has opened out to you and you're enjoying that? Or is that a kind of take it or leave it thing that you don't really care?
Well, it's nice to be. It's because I have been to a few writers' festivals. I didn't realise how much fun they were all having. All the, you know, when I did sort of laugh a little bit with my publisher, seeing all the, you know, obviously people who see each other year after year, and I was saying, I see. So I did feel like this is a party that I've only finally been invited to. But in a way, that's a very small. It's a very small world.
There's
the world of readers, and most of my, you know, my readers are hairdressers and barristers and musicians, and have a whole other world. They might not even know writers' festivals exist. They couldn't care less.
True.
They just pick up books.
Absolutely.
And then there's another whole world of non-readers, and I love non-readers.
Do
just
you?
As much.
You
of course
love
I
non-readers.
Do. Well, I find it sometimes. I find it quite refreshing to meet somebody who's not. I know this is a strange thing for an author to say, but I can't stand that whole snooty thing of, you know, reading makes you
a better person.
I don't actually...
But don't you want to convert them immediately? Don't you want to see... I mean, I always feel, if I meet a non-reader, I think, right, here's the challenge. Now I have to think of the book that's going to be the one that hooks
you
in. That
brings you into reading.
Don't you feel like that?
No, I think because they find, you know, they might be sporty people. They might find the passion that we feel from a book, they might find from extreme sports or from music or from... art. There's a whole, you know, so many different ways to enjoy the world. And if you're not a reader, then yes, that's great. You're right. If you could find a book that would give them that passion, that would be wonderful. But at the same time,
oh, you're so tolerant, so forgiving. I can't believe it. Now, let me ask you. You've mentioned your sister a few times today, and she often comes up in interviews. This is Jacqueline. Are you competitive by nature?
No, well, I think I'm probably more competitive than she is. I think she's a much nicer person than me. So I always say that it was my envy of her that pushed me to write my first book. But she seems genuinely, and I believe her, that she's happy for my success. But we are indifferent, so she writes young adult fiction. So she.
If she were writing in the same genre as you, do you think that would bother you, and or would it spur you on?
Maybe it would be harder. Maybe it would be different. We're definitely, both myself and my younger sister Nicola, where there is competition for material, and we do get quite cross with each other if somebody's taken.
So do you say hands off that? I want that story for myself. You do?
Oh yes. And my mother might sometimes call and start telling a story and say, oh, by the way, you can't use this, so I've already told Jackie said she wants it, it's hers. So yes,
you'd think your mother would have realised by now what dangerous terrain
she's in.
No,
that's right, exactly, and she should give it all to me first as the eldest.
So, given that you seem to be quite fast in churning books out quite rapidly, you've been very, very productive, I have to ask, as well as having Truly Madly Guilty out now, have you got something else on the go?
No, I don't. I'm desperate for an idea. So anything that anybody says at the moment, anything that anytime Mum calls me, anything I read in the paper, you know, just even this morning when things people were saying, I'm on the hunt for ideas. I don't really like it when I don't have them. I feel much more satisfied when I'm at least a third of the way in. That's when I'm happiest. So give me an idea.
Okay, but in the meantime, thank you so much for Truly Madly Guilty.
That's my absolute pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.